This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
I maintain some sort of cautious optimism that we are moving in the right direction, but it's very, very hard to get people and governments to stay focused on long-term goals when there are short-term things like inflation, disasters they're having to respond to, like a war happening, and all of those things are competing for attention.
While the soccer world turns its gaze to the first World Cup held in the Middle East, there was recently another important international gathering on the environmental front nearby. This week on Sea Change Radio, we speak to Andrea Thompson of Scientific American to get a better understanding of what was discussed at the United Nations Climate Change Conference, known as COP27, that just took place in Egypt. We look at the hurdles that need to be overcome by the major emitting countries, examine the impact of Russia's invasion of Ukraine, and talk about the irony that one of the least eco-friendly countries was hosting a global climate summit. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Andrea Thompson. She is an associate editor at Scientific American. Andrea, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thank you for having me.
So I wanted to talk about COP27, this latest climate summit, which is occurring in Sharm el-Sheikh, Egypt. You wrote a piece for Scientific American entitled "World Edges Closer to Meeting Climate Targets, But Not Fast Enough." Before we dive into the immediacy of COP27. Why don't you take a step back to the last couple of years and how the major emitters have evolved into where they are today?
Sure. So, you know, this all stems from the 2015 Paris Accord, where countries agreed to limit warming to well under 2 degrees Celsius, preferably 1.5 degrees Celsius. And under that agreement, countries can set their own, what are called in UN parlance, nationally determined contributions, but it's essentially how much they're going to reduce emissions by a specific year. And generally, those are targeted to about 2030. And there's been quite a bit of change over the last couple of years. Prior to the last meeting, which was in Glasgow last year, obviously the pandemic interrupted things. We weren't able to have the meetings, and so that slowed a little bit of this down. You know, countries are supposed to increase the aggressiveness of their emissions targets every 5 years, which was supposed to happen in 2020. The pandemic interrupted that. So a lot of that sort of happened before the Glasgow meeting last year. And what they tried to do with the meeting last year was get countries to increase their targets on a more rapid pace. So instead of every 5 years, to actually trying to motivate them to do it before this meeting. And one thing we saw is that really didn't happen. Of the countries that did sort of did submit formal pledges before this meeting, most of them were sort of playing catch up. They hadn't done that before Glasgow. There were some movement. Probably most notably was that the U.S. actually put some teeth behind their pledge. So President Biden, after he took office, made a pledge to reduce emissions about 50% by 2030 in the U.S. But there wasn't really the policy to make that happen until the Inflation Reduction Act passed this past summer. Now, it doesn't get us all the way there, but the studies that have been done suggest it could reduce emissions by anywhere from 30 to 40%, which is a pretty good chunk. So that was probably one of the biggest changes in the last year, was that, you know, the U.S. got a lot more credibility in terms of being able to meet its pledge, which when you're dealing with these UN meetings is really important. if the U.S. is trying to be a leader on this to back up what they say they're going to do, it is really crucial. One other issue has been sort of a little bit of a freeze in relations between China and the U.S. And it was under President Obama that a lot of the movement towards, you know, the Paris Agreement and towards getting China to make some pledges happened because of diplomatic moves then. And the last couple of years has been this little bit of a freeze, and that is potentially thawing now. President Biden and Premier Xi Jinping met this week. Obviously, you have to see how that's going to take shape moving forward, but it's, you know, potentially a good sign. And then, of course, the war in Ukraine is a big factor in right now in terms of how quickly countries are able to make some of the pledges they wanted to make, particularly in Europe, which is so dependent on fuel from Russia. They're having to really quickly pivot to try and find alternate sources of fuel. And in some cases, that's potentially prolonging how long things like coal-fired power plants are being used. So those are a lot of the background things that have kind of happened, or at least some of the main ones coming into this COP meeting.
So a lot of these are political. How suspicious or how wary are other global powers towards America's stance to things like these climate summits when we saw such a zigzag, such a pendulum swing from the Obama era to the Trump presidency and now back to President Biden? I mean, what happened in 2019 in Chile in COP25? I don't really recall what the U.S. role was during that first year of the Trump presidency. Did the Americans even participate?
So they've participated, from what I recall. They've always sent a delegation, but I do think during the Trump years, there was a bit more emphasis on what they called American energy independence, so promoting the domestic production of fossil fuels to keep prices lower for Americans. So some of that rhetoric definitely happened with the delegations that we did send to those meetings. From what I recall, a lot of the Trump administration attitude towards those COP meetings was a little more benign neglect than total outright hostility, other than the main thing that Trump did on that front was to pull the U.S. out of the Paris Climate Accord. So the first and only country to do that. Of course, President Biden, one of the first things he did when he came into office was to put the U.S. back in. So that was a fairly short-lived effect.
You could see that being ominous in terms of creating trust within the signatory countries, right?
Absolutely. And I think, you know, as I said, that the pledges countries make under the Paris Accord are voluntary. There's no binding language that they have to follow them. So to some extent, what happens, it's a little more important what is actually happening on the ground in a country than what they say they're going to do on any pledge. And that's where the Inflation Reduction Act probably comes in and is probably doing a lot to, you know, assuage concerns, because I do think most of the people that work in diplomatic circles at that level have a pretty good understanding of the American political system and are aware that with a law like that, you know, that's really hard for Republicans who might be averse to some of the provisions to undo. It's sort of, in a lot of ways, a done deal. And having that law on the books is much more important than any particular pledge Biden has set, you know, in terms of actual emissions reductions.
Why don't we focus a little bit on the science aspect of it right now? The subtitle of your piece in Scientific American is, "As the COP27 Climate Summit Begins, Emissions Reduction Pledges Are Still Far Behind Where They Need to Be to Meet the Goals to Limit Global Warming." I'm particularly interested in one of the largest emitters on the planet, the second largest per capita in terms of greenhouse gas emissions, Russia. I mean, they have become an outcast nation largely over the last 8 months. How is that being reflected in terms of getting them on the table in a productive, transparent way at a summit like this?
Yeah, and I don't know a ton about the actual diplomatic engagement that is or is not happening on that level. But I do know from the experts I've talked to that Russia's pledges, they do have a pledge, but it's sort of, it's something they can easily meet. It's not really, it's not aggressive. It's not ambitious.
It's interesting that while the diplomatic community is treating Russia with draconian measures, and from the sound of it, the COP27 participants are hoping to just keep them at the table. Is that a fair assumption? This isn't the time to kind of turn the screws on them, is what you're saying, maybe.
Yeah, and I honestly, I don't know exactly how much the engagement with Russia in terms of getting them to make pledges is really a key concern. You know, this time I think much more is how they are impacting the ability of other countries to meet their targets, because particularly Europe, the European Union, has pretty aggressive targets. The situation right now is sort of having a number of different effects. Like I said, it's, you know, in some cases, it means that coal-fired plants may be online longer than they were in the past. Now, it's not expected that they will be on for, you know, years and years to where they're going to make a really big impact, but it's still, you know, not ideal. And I think in the other aspect is there is concern because European countries are having to pivot to other sources of natural gas, they're having to build infrastructure to get those natural gas imports, such as shipping from the U.S. versus the pipeline they have from Russia. And anytime you're building infrastructure that is very expensive, that tends to put, you know, some pressure to sort of get the most use out of it. So there's some concerns that if they're building that infrastructure, they're going to want to keep importing fossil fuels for longer than they would have otherwise. But there is also some movement to really more aggressively ramp up renewable energy. So I think it's a little uncertain as to how all those things are going to balance out. I think in the long term, the sense is that it's probably going to favor renewable energy. It's just a question of how long things like natural gas kind of stay entrenched there because of this.
Joseph's face was black as night. The pale yellow moon shone in his eyes. His path was marked by the stars in the southern hemisphere, and he walked his days under Africa's skies. This is the story of how we begin to remember. This is the powerful pulsing of love in the vein. After the dream of falling and calling your name out, these are the roots of rhythm, and the roots of rhythm remain.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio, and I'm speaking to Andrea Thompson. She covers sustainability for Scientific American. So we've been talking about the major players in this conference, the COP27 Climate Summit in Sharm el-Sheikh, Egypt, Andrea. But let's talk about countries like Egypt or the next host of COP28, the United Arab Emirates. I'm interested in how they're participating and how the major emitters are treating them. Has it become kind of this paternalistic dynamic, or do they have an important voice at this conference in your estimation?
So I think broadly speaking, the role of, and it's, you know, it's hard to find the right term for countries, but what you might broadly cover called developing countries, that their voices have definitely become louder in the last couple years, particularly around the issue of what's called loss and damages. And those are when you have, you know, say a climate fuel disaster or something like sea level rise, where you have losses, you know, financial livelihood that wouldn't have happened without climate change. And developing countries who, you know, historically have contributed extremely little to the problem of climate change, are often some of the countries that are really bearing the brunt of the impacts and that often have the least capacity to prepare for them and to recover from them.
Do you have an example in mind?
Sure. So I think a really recent example would be the flooding that happened in Nigeria last month. That, you know, we know there's a really strong linkage between warming and increases in heavy rainfalls. And so a country like that, you know, may not have the, it has huge sweeping impacts. You know, that level of flooding would obviously have impacts in the U.S., but the U.S. has a really robust emergency response structure. We have things like insurance. We have things that can help make people whole again. They're not perfect by any means, but those are often completely lacking in countries in the developing world. And they don't have necessarily have the funding to put those in place, because they have a lot of different things they're trying to do at the same time. And so a lot of countries have raised those as saying, look, we're dealing with the impacts much more than the countries that cause most of this problem. We're not as able to respond. You need to help us. So a big part of the debate at this COP meeting is whether developed countries will get behind a fund, a dedicated fund, to help make some of these, to help alleviate some of these costs. It's a very contentious thing. Countries like the U.S. are particularly averse to it because they think it opens up the possibility of litigation. You know, whether or not it does is beyond my expertise, but you know, that's the concern they cite. Now there is also more push for funding for adaptation for countries, and there's a little bit more movement on that front. But you know, they're asking for funding at a bunch of different levels to mitigate, to adapt, and to put right the losses that are, you know, things you can't adapt to anymore, that are just sort of done deals. So yeah, that's been a huge consideration coming into that, and the countries behind it have been really, really vocal about it, and you know, were successful in getting it on the agenda this time.
So Andrea, while we're talking about the host country dynamic, you know, the more developing countries as opposed to the major emitters who are participating in COP27, I can't help but think of the contrasts that a lot of these countries offer. Egypt is a perfect example. I mean, you have, I remember reading that they were turning Sharm el-Sheikh into this green zone, almost a fantasy land compared to the rest of the country. I mean, you'd be very hard pressed to find one electric vehicle in Cairo. I've never seen such traffic and air pollution before. That's not to impugn Egypt as much as that's just the reality with some of these countries, that their economic situation lends itself to not having a very efficient grid, transportation system, et cetera. Maybe kind of highlight the dichotomy that guests are seeing when they go into a place like Sharm el-Sheikh. I know you're not there, but it's pretty obvious that there's very much these two worlds that are being presented, one to the rest of the world, and one where I think most Egyptians would find pretty humorous that Egypt is hosting this green summit.
Yeah, I think most of the people that are attending a meeting like COP, the negotiators, the activists, the scientists, are probably pretty aware of that dichotomy. I don't think that is lost on them at all. I think, especially because a lot of them have been to these meetings before, they know the kind of production it is.
Well, let me interrupt real quickly. You mentioned activists. They're actually not allowed. There's been a lot of these activists, like Human Rights Watch, usually attends these things, and they're not allowed to go because of the stranglehold that the Egyptian government has had on who gets to attend. And we know that I think 65,000 political prisoners are behind bars in Egypt because of their political dissension.
Yeah, and that's, I will say that's one I can't really speak super authoritatively on. I know mostly what's been reported elsewhere, that protests compared to previous cups have been really, really limited. You particularly don't see anything outside the venues, outside the sort of blue zone. Mm-hmm. And, you know, several activists that have been there speaking at the conference have really noted that and what a difference that can make, because those protests can, you know, sort of be a good reminder to the people who are inside negotiating, you know, what they're negotiating for and who is, what is really at stake here. You know, I think that that dichotomy, I do think that's something that probably the people who would be, who have been doing this for a while and are really into this issue, which by and large are the people that, you know, attending COP, are really aware of. I don't think that that's lost on them. You know, it's how much I think that that is translated to the broader global public is really dependent on how media covers the story and whether that's highlighted or not. And that, you know, varies a whole lot. There are there are so many news outlets now and so many ways to cover a story. And I'm sure that some places are trying to get that story across. But there is also the tendency to really be sort of focused on the nitty gritty day to day negotiations that are happening at COP.
I don't intend to stop. I don't intend to stand. I don't intend to die in Egypt land. I don't intend to stop till I reach the promised land. I don't intend to die in Egypt land. Lord, I can't stay away, Lord, I can't stay away, Lord, I can't stay away. I don't intend to die in Egypt land. The pilot's wife, she had a dream. I don't intend to die in Egypt land. Bad and honest man she seemed. I don't intend to die in Egypt land. Go bring me some water, let me wash my hands. I don't intend to die in Egypt land. I shan't be guilty of an innocent man.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio, and I'm speaking to Andrea Thompson. She covers sustainability for Scientific American. So what do you want Scientific American readers to take away from reading about COP? It's very complicated, irrespective of the politics and the optics and all, and the activism, etc.
Yeah, so I think from, you know, just as someone covering this, that's something I stay aware of. But the thing I try to impart to our readers is really that broader context, which is what this story that you mentioned was getting at, that if we want to meet these targets we have set, and those targets are, you know, they're science-based, they'll help us avoid the impacts of climate change being ever worse. Because we're at, depending on, you know, the exact temperature record you're looking at, we're a little over 1 degree Celsius of warming above pre-industrial levels. And we are very clearly already seeing very devastating impacts of climate change. We are seeing that in intense droughts. We are seeing that in the heat waves that we had all over the world this summer, that it's very, very easy to pick out the signature of climate change in those, that they are happening more often, that they are worse, that they last longer than they would, you know, in a world without climate change. And every degree, every fraction of a degree of warming that we avoid, the better. Every little bit makes a difference in terms of not making this problem worse. And, you know, this story that you mentioned, you know, the graphic shows the gap we have to meeting those ambitions.
Yeah, since this is an audio format, explain the graphic and these gaps and break down the numbers as simply as you can for our listeners.
You know, so the graphic shows, I think one thing that's helpful to point out, it shows, you know, if we were still operating under the policies that were in place around the world as of 2010, you know, that greenhouse gas emissions would be going up pretty steadily. Based on current policies, they're still going up. They're not going up as steeply. There's a little bit of a kink in that line because of all of the lockdowns around the pandemic, where, you know, a lot of travel and electricity use and stuff stopped. But, you know, we've since come back from that. So that was just a blip. But then sort of under that line, you can see, based on the pledges that countries have made, they say this is how much we will reduce emissions by 2030. You can see that emissions would start to go down. Now, they don't go down as much as the lines where we're meeting a limit of 2 degrees Celsius warming or a limit of 1.5 degrees Celsius warming, but they're still going down, so it's good. The issue there is that the policies aren't in place to back up those pledges. So until those policies are in place, things like laws like the Infrastructure or the Inflation Reduction Act, those pledges are sort of just, I don't want to say empty promises, but they're unfulfilled promises, I guess.
And largely aspirational at times.
Yes. And in some cases, you know, the experts I talked to said, you know, in some cases, some countries are actually doing more on the ground than their pledges account for. So India is a good example of this. India does not have a super ambitious pledge. They, under the terms of the Paris Agreement, they don't need to. They're not as pushed to as some other countries. But their policies on the ground make it that they will easily meet their pledge and probably surpass it. So there's, you know, a lot of, and that's, we tried to show that there's uncertainty in these lines. They're not set in stone. But so there's a little bit that's masked there. But then you have the US, where we only have the policies to partly hit the target we've set. And, you know, you can see in the graphic, it shows the gap between pledges and what we would need to reduce emissions by to hit 2 degrees Celsius or 1.5 degrees Celsius. And for 2 degrees, it's about 12 gigatons of carbon dioxide equivalent. And for 1.5, it's 20. And those are pretty big numbers. They're not insurmountable. We have the technical capacity to meet those. It's really a political issue. It's, you know, it's having the political will and getting countries to all act in the same direction. And that's a really, really hard thing to do, because leaders and countries are balancing so many other things, which is understandable. That is their job and they have to do that. But, you know, this is a very existential problem. And if we have a limited amount of time to meet these goals, but it is at least a sign of some forward action, whereas, you know, 10 years ago, we weren't really even seeing that. So I, you know, as someone who's covered this for a long time, I maintain some sort of cautious optimism that we are moving in the right direction. But it's very, very hard to get people and governments to stay focused on long-term goals when there are short-term things like inflation, disasters they're having to respond to, like a war happening. And all of those things are competing for attention.
She's an associate editor at Scientific American, Andrea Thompson. Andrea, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thanks for having me.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by Fela Kuti, Paul Simon, and Josh White. To read a transcript of this show, go to seachangeradio.com. Stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast on our site or visit our archives to hear from Doris Kearns Goodwin, Gavin Newsom, Stuart Brand, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week, as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.